Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
It's okay to be scared. I'm scared too.
Boils and ghouls, lock your doors and strap yourselves in. From Los Angeles, California, Bloody Disgusting presents the Boo Crew Podcast. Horror news, commentary, reviews, interviews, and more. With your hosts, Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio.
Well, hello, howdy, and hi there. My name is Trevor, and on behalf of myself, Lauren and Leo, welcome to your Boo Crew Podcast, episode 398. I'm trying my best not to sound like a used car salesman or a game show host, which someone commented on Apple Podcasts. You can leave your review over at Apple Podcasts. We appreciate it so much. It helps the show get found, and we just like connecting with you in that way. At time of release, hope you had an awesome Labor Day weekend and spent it with some great horror movies. I know over at the Shand household, my 14-year-old terror teen Scarlett did a rewatch of Jennifer's Body. I think, gosh, she must have seen it like 5 or 6 times at this point. And I've been doing this thing where I look for TikToks with the tag horror movies that are actually scary. And I go down any rabbit hole that includes the films Lake Mungo, The Taking of Deborah Logan, House of the Devil, and It Follows. It's got to be at least 2 of those on the list. And then I'm in. One movie I discovered for myself, and actually I've heard of people mention this and I've just never got around to seeing it, but I keep seeing it on these lists, is Gonjiam Haunted Asylum. I'm probably butchering that name, but wow, that was amazing. And I watched it back to back with another film called Grave Encounters, and the two have the found footage aspect of a paranormal internet TV show. Both of these are movies where right after you watch them, and you gotta somehow get from wherever your TV is to your bedroom if you're not watching it in bed, which you could just hide under the covers, and enough said. But if you gotta get from point A to point B, you know you're making a run down the hall and you keep looking behind you thinking that something from that movie is gonna be standing there in the shadows. Strong recommend if you haven't seen them already. I'll keep you posted as we add to the list of good ones here. Another good one, actually fantastic one, gets the main event for this episode. The Nun 2 is released only in theaters on September 8th, and we celebrate its awesomeness with returning guest Michael Chaves. He steps into the confessional to take you down the cobblestone streets of France and dimly lit abbeys for the sequel to the most successful film in the entire Conjuring universe. Hear about Thaisa Farmiga and Jonas Bloquet reuniting with their fantastic characters in a horrifying and fun way. Explore the stunning choreography of terror and the brilliant performance from Bonnie Ahrens as she brings to life once again one of the most iconic evils in cinema history. Where does this all fit in the timeline of the Conjuring universe? How do they do that magazine gag from the trailer? Why is Valak so awesome? So many questions. See if your prayers are answered with episode 398 and Michael Chaves now slaying.
Go ahead, scream. That's all we need.
Another victim crawls onto the gurney for a Boo Crew autopsy.
Joining Bloody Disgusting's Boo Crew in the Speakeasy Studio is a visionary filmmaker and returning guest of the show, earning a degree in film and production at the Arts Center College of Design in Pasadena. He's made commercials, documentaries, and the spectacular award-winning short The Maiden in 2016, which is a must watch. In fact, you can stop this right now if you haven't seen it. Go watch it on Vimeo. Come back. It's about 9 minutes long, and it is seriously that good. In 2019, he was selected to direct the absolutely terrifying video for Bury a Friend by the now 7-time Grammy-winning Billie Eilish. Besides starting a whole new trajectory in style and cinematic music video creation, the nightmarish vision was integral in defining an entire era for the singer, earning almost 500 million views and helping her earn her first number one on the Billboard charts, making history. That same year, his singular approach to world-building, tone, and menace commanded the attention of James Wan, who thrust him into the highest-grossing horror franchise of all time, The Conjuring Universe. This was done through the lens of its sixth installment, the stunning award-winning Curse of La Llorona. He was brought back to helm 2021's Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It, that was instrumental in the return of the theatrical experience, having the biggest R-rated opening of the entire pandemic. His latest brings him back to The Conjuring Universe once again, now having directed more of the films within it than anyone else associated, including James Wan himself. The Nun 2 finds sister Irene and Frenchie 4 years after the events of the first film, as they once again come face to face with one of the most malevolent and iconic forces in cinema history, Valak, the demon nun. Only in theaters September 8th, we are incredibly honored to welcome back its creator, Mr. Michael Shavs. Yeah, my man.
Thank you, guys. Oh, my gosh. What an incredible intro. I'm like, I want to meet that guy. He sounds really accomplished. Like, he's done some stuff.
Yeah, exactly. He has. He has, man. Well, again, thank you so much for spending time with us to celebrate another extraordinary project. How does it feel to have another milestone kind of being the official opener to what is essentially the first real Halloween season since 2019?
You know, I'm so proud of it. I really love this movie. It's you love your movies, you love all the stuff, like you love your children, you know. It's like they're like your little babies, but it's like, and so it's hard to say one's a favorite, but this is my favorite. Yeah. I'm really proud of this. It's you know, I think I had a blast making it, and it was one of those things that I was supported by a great crew. We shot in France. It was the south of France. I mean, it was, you know, I brought my family there, which was just
that's
incredible
great.
Experience. It's kind of one of those dream experiences where you're like, oh, it'd be cool to be a director, one. And then two, it'd be like cool to be shooting in a cool location. And
yeah,
honestly, you can't beat France and the south of France. And we went there for 6 months and
oh my God,
just had like an epic experience. And yeah.
Oh, did the kids have to go to school there at the time, or was it over summer or winter? What was the situation?
You know, my wife homeschooled them, and so great. that was great.
Yeah,
and you bless know, her.
Yeah, seriously, wow.
Yeah, and she works full time too, so she was like working remotely, and I don't even know how she's still recovering. She's still like catching up on sleep from that.
And were you shooting during the pandemic?
No, it was after. Well, I guess is the pandemic done? I mean, we had to wear masks.
Quotes,
that's the crazy
unquote,
thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, we started shooting summer of last year, and then it went into the winter.
Got it.
And we've been just, you know, doing post and finishing up this past year, and it's brought us up to this point.
Wow. So we were fortunate enough, we were talking briefly about it, to be at this special fan screening that happened here in downtown LA. It was unbelievable. I was wondering if you could walk anyone through the experience, kind of the setup of what was going on to premiere this movie to the fans, and how special that felt, kind of being the first real time you could actually do this like this in a cinema since 2019, basically.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, we're in such a unique situation right now just because of the strikes.
Yes.
So we couldn't have everyone was really sensitive, like, you know, we couldn't have a traditional premiere. We couldn't have a premiere with the actors and the writers. So, you know, the question came up about what would we do? And, you know, we're coming up, this is 10 years from the first Conjuring film. Mm. The Conjuring Universe has been around 10 years. And, I started just throwing around the idea of like, I'd love to just do something that's like totally fan centric, that this would be an event that's, you know, it's not, cause premieres are always about like patting yourself on the back.
Yeah.
In a way. And I was like, you know, this is like, you know, we're 10 years into it. Like, I owe my career to the Conjuring Universe. And, you know, I am started out as a fan, and the idea that, you know, we're here really, you know, because of the fans, that they have supported this for all these years. I really wanted to do something that celebrated that. So that's kind of, we started rolling with that, and then it just developed. And It became the night that it did, but it was a really, cool experience. You know, it was great to just, you know, be surrounded by people who loved the series, and it was great.
Yeah. And that kind of cavalcade of demon nuns that basically attacked everybody in the audience was insane.
That was so
it was
fun.
So cool. There was like a, but what is it called? Like a,
procession?
Procession. Yes, yeah. Yes. It was a procession of all these nuns, and you couldn't see their faces, and they were holding candles, and they were going down all the aisles, and they were standing there, and this the haunting music was playing, and they were scaring people. It was so awesome. And then right in front of you on this beautifully lit screen with these red velvet curtains was the face of Valak, the demon nun, Bonnie Aarons herself in full glory.
With all these red lights.
Yeah, exactly.
And I loved how many people dressed up as Valak.
Yes, people were coming dressed cosplay. Up as nuns and Valak. And, oh.
It was amazing.
Yeah. That's what I wanted to wear. Yeah. But my wife wouldn't let me. I was totally, I had my Valak cosplay, and she was like, "You're not leaving the house like that."
So. And early reviews have been obviously deservingly insane for this. They've been glowing. Every single one of them has been saying the scares are upped in extraordinary ways. The story is fantastic. It's more an intense of a ride, and really we could not agree more. However, I want to also mention that is no way a slight to what Corin did with the first one. We are huge fans of that one as well. It's a gothic atmospheric masterpiece, a completely different experience. What was the advantage of having such a beautiful setup like that? How did you use that to empower yourself going into this one?
Yeah, you know, I owe a lot to Corin. I mean, that was I don't think people realize what a big swing that was in the Conjuring universe. I think up to this point, the Conjuring movies had been these basically a variation of the haunted house formula. And the idea, and also all set in America, and the idea that he was going to take this and basically do like a Bram Stoker's Dracula. First of all, Corin is amazing.
Yeah,
and you know, he is such a good, you know, consider him a friend. I think he's just so talented. And it was like so up his alley to do something that had that kind of cool, lush, you know, Bram Stoker's Dracula vibe. And he did a great job with it. And I think that was something that I really enjoyed. And I really think that it was so, and I think it's the most successful Conjuring film. It's, and I think fans really responded to that. And I think it shows like they have that like need for the gothic horror. And then also within the kind of the world of the Conjuring, I think that really resonated. It's so, you know, I was really excited because I think that, you know, at its core, it's like you got an incredible villain. And I think that was one of those things that, I love Bonnie and I love the character that she created. It's like, she's such a iconic, you know, horror movie villain. I mean, it's amazing. The, you know, we're in your recording studio and your house is like, you know, a shrine to like these great horror icons. And it's like, I feel like that about Bonnie. I think that she is like up on a pedestal with, you know, some of the best, you know, horror villains of all time. So that was, I think, one of the big reasons that I was drawn to it. And then I totally forgot your question. I don't even know.
That's
like
great.
Going
no,
up, I was just so thinking about like what a great job Corin did.
Yeah, no, you hit on everything beautifully. Backing up a little bit, how did the whole opportunity come up, and when did your name kind of start being tossed around to take the helm of this one?
You know, I think it was after Conjuring 3, I was developing a couple different projects, and it was something that New Line just called, and they floated it out to me. And you know, at first I was not sure if I wanted to jump into another Conjuring movie. But I really like The Nun. And I also love they had a script that was, the first draft was written by Akela Cooper, and she's so talented. She wrote a really great draft. And, even though we develop things in the movie, there's so much of it. Even when we took it in other directions and development, I inevitably would come back to that, 'cause I think it really had an impact on me. And she just did a great job with that script. And so that sucked me. And I was like, okay, I love the script. I love the villain. And you know, those are like the essentials. And then, you know, the last thing is, you know, I had become friends with Corin as I was doing La Llorona and he was doing The Nun. And then I saw, you know, I saw him working with Thais and Jonas. Mm-hmm. They were doing like a pickup on the lot, and I got to meet them, and they're amazing too. Thais and Jonas were like, and they had such a great relationship together. And I was like, oh, that seems like a really cool set. They seem like really cool people. And I'd love to be working with people like that. I've been really lucky to be said, I've been really lucky with all my cast. They're like, everybody I've worked with has been some degree of awesome. And you know, that was also kind of went into the calculus because, you know, you're on these movies for so long.
Yeah.
And so much of it is like, it does, you know, it's like, there's the kind of, this is like the wish fulfillment. This is like the dream, you know, and I'm so happy to be doing this. Also, though, you get like, you know, 30-40 days in, it becomes the job. And then you really just have to make sure that the people you're working with are you love seeing every day and you really love showing up to work with. And they're that type of people. Like they're just so awesome. They got a great energy. They love. Actually, Thais is terrified.
That's what I've heard about her. That's a great thing, right?
Yeah. No, totally. And so, like, when she's scared, I'm thinking, is she like legitimately scared, or is it like she's just channeling like this? She actually has an amazing process, which is like a whole another thing. But like, really? She was great, and then Jonas is great. He's so passionate, and he's also so fun. And they actually have this like weird, almost like. These kind of mirror images of the Warrens, you know, she obviously, you know, Vera's sister, she looks just like Vera. And then he kind of has that, like, he looks a little bit like Patrick, and they like, there's something about them that they're almost like the mirror images of the Condry. And so and I didn't realize that until I started working with them. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's like the same movie with the same people.
That is so cool. From your perspective, what was it like to watch them reconnect with those characters? You know, they're instrumental in creating.
They loved it. I mean, they also have like a great friendship. I mean, when they were working on set, it was kind of like, you know, kids at camp where, you know, you could see that they had this incredible history together and they were so energized to be working together again. And I think they really liked where we took the characters. I mean, I really loved in the first Nun, I think that they had this like really cool chemistry where there's a little bit of flirtation. He's a little bit of a dog. And then she's obviously becoming a nun and, you know, she doesn't want, you know, even if there's an energy there, she can't like, you know, it's the thing that could never happen. And I was like, that's great. You know, that's a really cool thing that they developed in that. And so I thought what was great with this is like just a chance to take the characters further and to just see how that story develops. And then, you know, well, what happens? We all know in the last one that he gets possessed and, you know, well, what, you know, where does it go from there?
Yeah. What role does James Wan kind of have in steering the trajectories of these characters? Or does he kind of leave their evolution in the hands of the directors and writers who go on with it?
You know, he gave us a lot of flexibility. I mean, he's the Stan Lee of the universe. I mean, it's like that. There cannot be his impact and on the universe cannot be understated. And there's only like a couple universes that exist successfully. And it's like, he's created one of them. So, you know, he always, you know, has it's always been his design, to keep consistent with our timeline. And the timeline was set up, basically, I think I wasn't a part of it, but it was between, you know, Conjuring 1 and 2. Frenchie's exorcism is a pivotal moment in the Conjuring universe. We see it in the first one. We see it more, and we know Valak's connected to it in the second one. And that's, you know, at a later date and after, you know, the events of this movie. So it was always part of that design that he set up very early on.
Wow.
That we're always kind of moving towards this kind of one kind of center point in the universe. But beyond that, I think that there was, you know, he gives a lot of freedom, and I think he gives it to all the directors he works with. And it's at this point, you know, also credit to New Line. I think it's like they've been incredibly supportive and really just open to the things I've wanted to do.
Right.
Did anybody come in and bless the set before?
I've heard that this happens
every day. Because it got increasingly more evil.
Yeah.
And so you needed to ramp up. It became an arms race, a blessing and evil.
Are you being serious? Was there?
I mean, it got it. No, well, we did one blessing in the beginning. It is absolute.
But there was a blessing.
There was a blessing.
Yeah.
In Conjuring tradition, there's always a blessing at the beginning of the of it. And we actually, our first day of shooting was at the church in the opening. So the opening, there's like the events of the opening, which are kind of, there's a horrific incident that happens there. That was basically our first scene that we were shooting. And we had a church, a priest come in. That's actually not a functioning church. It's been a decommissioned church, basically, because what we wanted to do in there, there's no, like, the Catholic church.
Oh, yeah. No way.
And even the, like, it even became very difficult to to shoot in there just because the town was hearing what we were going to do.
Sure.
And they were like, no, this is like a tourist attraction church. You can't like have this, like make this famous for like
blasphemy.
This horrific, like yeah. blasphemous act. But yeah, 100%. We start with a blessing. That's always one of the Conjuring traditions. And yeah, I'll probably do that even on my non-horror.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Movies,
now it's like
know?
A good luck thing, right?
Yeah. Seriously.
Would you say there's a creative shorthand, you know, now helming three Conjuring universe movies that is consistent in that universe? Is there kind of a, I don't know, a common denominator that is applied to all that?
Kind of. I think that you're always trying to, you know, I started out as a fan. I saw this like the first one, just like everyone else. And, you know, it's part of it is just you're always trying to think about it from a fan perspective and you always want it to be surprising. Like it can't totally take a left turn and become a different movie. You know, you have to, it has to be a Conjuring movie at its core. But within that, I think that there, you're always looking for something else. You're always looking for something strange or weird, because I think, you know, being scared, it's a, there's the element of surprise and there's the element of the unknown. And I think that that's always a tricky balance, is like, you're trying to deliver on something that, you know, this core DNA that, you know, I fell in love with and millions of people fell in love with. And what is that core experience? But then also trying to, you know, create sequences and scares that you haven't seen before.
Exactly. Yeah. And to evolve the series, which is what you've done in spades on this one, man.
Oh, thanks.
I wanted to note that religion has this awesome way in immersing us in the mystical and magical and horror, but at the same time grounding it in actual real life history. And you can look no further than the Indiana Jones movies to kind of see how that's incorporated. What storytelling power do you think exists in that aspect of the human experience? I mean, we're terrified of The Exorcist in movies like this, where things that could be real.
Yeah, no, I think that that's one of those things. I think that there's so much of horror and these horror movies that center around the supernatural
yeah.
are these stories of faith. And I think it kind of taps into, you know, a desire. Like, I love the Mulder. I want to believe.
Yes, yes.
You know, the idea, and I think that's like, you know, I was raised Catholic, and I think that there's something with the supernatural. It's like, it comes from just like a deep desire to believe in something. And, you know, the, and also I think that's the, it's the push pull of like, you want to believe, but you also want to be terrified, and you want it to not be real. So it's like I think that that is really, you know, I don't know. It's a space that I'm always drawn to. I think that that was one of those things that, you know, in the elements of our movie, I don't know if we can get into spoilers or if that, you know, matters, but the, you know, there's like some real historical elements in our movie
yes.
that were not there in the first draft. Akil's draft was like off
oh,
the charts. Awesome.
Wow.
Like,
wow.
But it didn't have the, it had a saint in there that was a fictionalized saint. And I was just like, I don't know about that. It just, something about it just felt a little, especially because I was raised Catholic, and it's like,
yeah,
I know, like, we got a million saints. You know, that's
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, we are not short on saints.
Gotta be one in there.
Yeah. And they all died horrifically. That's yeah. kind of like the core of being a saint. So I'm like, it's like the perfect fodder for a horror movie. And it evolved into a conversation that I was just randomly having with David Leslie Johnson, who, you know, he wrote Conjuring 3 and Conjuring 2. And, you know, he's one of the kind of the brain trusts of the Conjuring universe in a lot of ways. And a very awesome guy and talented writer. And we just were kicking around the idea, and he was like, you know, you should do something with St. Lucy. You know, it's like the imagery so, you know, horrific. And I was like, oh yeah, no, of course. And that's like, you know, Guillermo del Toro was inspired by St. Lucy for the monster in Pan's Labyrinth,
yes.
the monster with the eyes on its hands. At least I suspect, because it's like such, you
yeah.
know, I know he has like, you know, lots of Catholic, you know, inspiration. But I was like, that image always grabbed me. And, you know, when DLJ said that, I was like, oh my gosh, that's a great idea. We should totally do that. And then the more that I read up on her, because I only really knew her from the pictures with
yeah.
the hands on her eyes.
Yeah.
I thought, I don't know, is this, I didn't know much. Was she a saint afflicted with eyes on her hands? Is that what it was all about? But it's like the story of, you know, her, of her torture and all of that. I was like, this is so compelling. And I was like, this has got to get into the movie.
Oh yeah, man.
I'm yeah. so glad you picked that.
I loved it.
Googled it.
Yeah. The whole ride back. I'm like, oh my God, it's real. Oh my God.
It's like, it's a real thing.
Based on a true story.
I mean, I think that's like the kind of the promise of the core Conjuring movies.
Yes.
It's like, what makes those so exciting is the Warren Case Files. And,
yes.
and I think that, you know, The Nun is like, I think in a wonderful way, it's been this great departure from that. But I think at its core, you want these things to pull you back in and be like, no, this is real.
Yeah, you're bringing
like,
it back,
there's real
man.
Elements in it. And like that, I don't know, that really resonates with me. That always hits a chord.
Did anything creepy happen on the set that wasn't planned?
Well, two people got murdered. And we have not talked about it, but I feel like this could be the
this
perfect venue.
Exclusive.
We have not found the bodies.
Oh,
I mean,
no.
So a lot of it is just theory, but they disappeared. And I asked Bonnie, I said, Bonnie, have you seen them? And she was like, nope. They're, you know, very, no, they're
Wily
wasn't.
Bonnie.
Oh, Bonnie.
She, but I don't know. I feel like there's something there and I don't want to point fingers, but
go to the nun too. See if you can solve the mystery. All right. Well, I want to talk about some of the new characters that you've kind of surrounded us with too. They're all awesome. We got Storm Reed, Anna Popplewell, Caitlin Rose Downey. What do they bring to the Conjuring universe that makes them unique?
Yeah. I love our new characters. I love our entire cast. I think Storm's great in that she's, you know, just this, I love with a lot of the main characters, we kind of just did a little twist on them where, yeah. You know, Thaisa is, you know, Irene in the beginning, she's in the first film, she's like the young recruit, and now she's like the senior member. And, you know, well, who is she mentoring? But, you know, we instead of, you know, someone who's doe-eyed like her, it's just, it's Storm, you know, it's Sister Deborah who, you know, she has a lot of attitude, she has a lot of energy that comes in. And I just thought that was this really kind of great counterpart. And there's something about her being a little skeptical on faith, being on this journey of faith. I thought that there was something really, really fun with that. And because it was something we couldn't do with Irene. Irene had already in the first film been on her journey of faith.
Yeah.
She made the commitment to God. She's like full on nun. She's not going back on that. So how can we take that story further? And, but it felt like I still wanted to have that with someone. And it feels like, and honestly, that was really with Akela's first draft is, you know, she's on that same journey. She's trying to sort out her faith and how seriously she takes, you know, the Catholic faith. And I mean, that's Storm's part there. With Caitlin and Anna, they were amazing. You know, it actually started with casting them. It started strangely. Usually you cast the adult and then you go for the kid. And mm-hmm. we found Caitlin first. We're just looking for just like a great Sophie. And it's set in France. And so we're first and foremost looking for French kids. And so, but we opened it up to casting like all over Europe. We looked everywhere and everywhere. And honestly, she came in and she was so amazing. And she was so magnetic. And you know, there was the first, you see the first tape. It's like basically they're posted online and you see it. And she's just so incredibly charming. But she's Irish. And I was like, okay, well, this is set in France. Do we get her to do a French accent or do like, yeah. And then it, you know, we brought her in. She was even more amazing. And she flew into, we cast in London. She was like flew in from Ireland. And what was so crazy is on the flight over, actually talking about what was strange is on the flight over. She saw her first nun. She's never seen a nun before in her whole little life. And the first time she sees a nun is on the plane with her. And she was kind of like, kind of terrified. She was kind of like
an omen.
She was like, is this an omen? And so it was just this amazing, I mean, that's actually the thing that the worst thing about the strike is you don't get to hear all these great stories from the amazing actors. Cause like they have so many great, they probably could tell you a bunch of creepy things, but yeah, she came in first and she was just amazing. I was like, we have got to cast this kid. I don't care, you know, what it is. We'll just say she's Irish and she's you know, just emigrated into, you know, France. And so then we started looking for her mom, and then Anna came in, and Anna's English, but I was like, Anna, can you do an Irish accent? It would be really awesome if you could pull that off. And she's amazing. She totally did. And that was it. And it was funny because when you're developing it, you think, oh, we really have to explain how they're Irish, you know, being in France,
right.
People are going to wonder, it'll be confusing. And there was like in the test audiences, there was, I think like one person who was upset about the accents, but generally people don't care.
Oh,
generally
yeah.
are like,
yeah.
It's Europe.
Exactly.
They're
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I
whatever.
Mean, I don't even know geography
right.
that well.
Exactly.
They're like, oh, it's right next
they're
to
all
it.
There.
You know?
The Boo Crew will be right back.
They don't live in coffins or appear only at night. Or run for fear of the light. They wait and watch and strike without warning. There is no place to hide When the Dead Are Alive. National General Pictures presents The Dead Are Alive, starring Samantha Eggar, Alex Cord, and John Marley. Victims, violence, vengeance. Behind eyes of fire, terror strikes to revenge desire. And there is no place to hide when the dead are alive. In color, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parents.
What all these characters brought out in Sister Irene, this whole new side that we didn't really get to see and explore in the first film. We get to see more of her backstory and how she's, you know, how she relates to the, with the children there and the state that she's in and kind of how the stakes are raised. Can you talk a little bit about the position that she's in right now?
Totally. You know, that was another thing that the story of her mom was not in that first draft.
Yeah.
It was actually more of like an Easter egg, like the idea that her, she has this connection and that this is a powerful connection was just kind of like a throwaway. And I was asking Akela about it, and it was such a throwaway that I didn't quite pick up on it. I was like, what is this thing? Which I won't go into details because it might spoil it, but I asked Akela, I was like, what do you mean by this? Like, what is this thing? And she was like, oh, it's, you know, the connection. I was like, oh, that's crazy. That's awesome. We got to make a deal with that. That is huge. And so that's something that, you know, we expanded from that point. Her story, you know what it was? It was that little thread that Akela said, and she was like, it was just a throwaway. I was like, we got to do something more with that. And then in the first film, she talks about her mom briefly. She talks about her dad, and it's a throwaway line about, her mom being, forget exactly what it was said, but basically that her mom might had something like this, and you know, something about her sight. And I was like, that's awesome. And it didn't entirely tie in with Akela's thing, but I was like, I think that this is something, let's try and like build this out, because this is really cool. And it was honestly kind of like with Rogue One, where that was all like a throwaway line from like, you know, how they got the Death Star plans.
Exactly.
I was like, this is great.
That.
Let's just keep on going.
Hear
with
that
this.
Story.
So that was something that I was like, okay, let's build this out. And then that became stronger and stronger. And it was, I really liked that. I think that it, I think it really built out her character, because it's, you know, it was just a little throwaway thread in that first movie. And I just thought with all of that, both, you know, her relationship with her mom, what was her mom's story? And then also the whole Jonas thing. I just thought, you know, these are things, I mean, I get sucked into these stories.
Yeah.
Like, and I was like, I want to have more. I want to see more as a fan. I want to get, you know, I want to see, you know, dig deeper into it. So that's how we got here.
Exactly. And then I love the intrigue in the respect that like, she's, nobody knows necessarily that she's the one associated with the events of the first film. She's almost like a folk hero undercover.
Totally.
And that is so fun to watch.
Totally.
You know, to be on the other side of that.
No, exactly. I mean, because that was one of those things, you know, with the Conjuring movies, they're almost kind of self-contained as their own, you know, their own stories, their own episodes. They don't really have this kind of vital continuity as like, you know, one building off of the next.
Yeah.
And I thought with this, like this, it's kind of great that you can just do that.
Exactly.
And then also like treat it as you really would. If you're a nun and you hear this story, first of all, you're going to be skeptical. You're like, even as much as you believe, you're going to be like, was it really a demon? Did all of that really happen? But it would become the stuff of folklore. And I just thought that's really exciting. And just the idea that she's not like someone who craves attention. She's not someone who craves celebrity, and she is like fully a nun. And that, I think, the humility, like this kind of humble, like life of poverty, this commitment to service. She's not going to be going out there on her book tour, like saying, I just defeated a demon. She's going to be going into the life of a nun. And there would be something very just like, you know, humble about
that.
Yes.
It says
incredible.
So much about her character.
Yeah.
You know? It's very consistent with it. I loved it. So we got to talk about the big baddie. Valak,
yes.
Right? I want to know, I mean, Bonnie Aaron's portrayal of Valak in this one it raises it up to a level that no one's seen before. People going into this are going to absolutely eat it up.
Yeah, Bonnie's really amazing. She really, first of all, is such a wonderful person and just, you know, a great ally in making the movie. Also just a great, she really gets the genre and she really gets her character. And it's the type of role that honestly she's deserved her whole life. It's, you know, this is, I mean, she's been this character actor, you know, for most of her life. And, you know, she was part of one of the best jump scares of all time with in Mulholland Drive. Mm-hmm. This is honestly, I think, her masterpiece. I think this character is really where she gets to show like what she can do. And we just talked about, you know, obviously when she's on screen, it needs to have a lot of power. So it's not something that we didn't want to overdo it. And we wanted to keep her scary. Kind of like the shark in Jaws.
Yes.
So, you know, she's always under the surface, but, you know, the actually, like, you know, when she appears, there is a certain power to that. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the big things with just in terms of throttling the Valak and just using it carefully. One of the things that I wanted in the story, and I think also fans wanted, was just to elaborate more on the history of Valak. And I think that tying that in with the story of St. Lucy, I thought that could be really, really cool and powerful and just make this into a much bigger story. The trick with that is, I think how it needs to be presented is it can't be concrete fact. It needs to be one of these things that still, the more you know something, the less scary it gets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more mystery and the less information you get, I mean, the more you can kind of project your own fears.
Exactly.
So there was drafts of the script where I think we went into maybe too much detail on her. So I think it was always like riding the line. It was always like riding the line of like how much of this is fact or how much of it is just the theories of, you know, our librarian character, Father Ridley, and just throttling that.
What about the choreography of Valak? Because there is something there, right? Like every time she like grips around a corner, even it seems very planned. Like every finger is like there's an intent to it. You feel it as an audience member.
No, totally.
So can you talk about that?
No, I mean, that's all Bonnie. I'm just like, Bonnie.
Wow.
Just be scary.
Oh my God. She was so freaking scary. Like there were close ups on her face and I was just like, oh my gosh, I'm so scared right now. And that final scene, that was,
oh my God,
insane. How many times did you guys have to do that?
It was a lot of shooting went into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. There was a lot of elements and there's a lot of shooting went into it.
It's beautiful. I know we can't talk about it, but wow. Yes. Wow. What about just in general showing the power of Valak? Because we really see just how terrifying Valak can be in this movie, probably more than any time we've ever seen the character. I mean, people are flying against walls with power so severe. It's unbelievable. It's like intense. I didn't expect that. I was like, holy God, what's going on? What were the challenges in bringing her power to life?
Yeah, you know, that's one of those things you always want to see something new in one of these movies. And part of it, I was thinking about just the different manifestations she could take. And it started with the idea of like, well, we can't show her that much. And honestly, Conjuring 2 was such a great kind of debut for her.
Yes.
And when we were going into it, I was like, you know, I want to see how much of the movie she's actually in. So I just went through the movie and I literally cut every point Bonnie's on screen. And you know, she's on screen less than a minute.
Wow.
Less than a minute in that entire movie. If you're only looking at, so don't count the whole scenes, but just like when you're looking at Bonnie's face, it's like something like 50 odd seconds.
No way.
Yeah. It's so small, but she has such a big impact.
Yes.
It really goes, and you don't really think about it. You're thinking, oh, maybe she's in there for 5 minutes, but no, less than a minute. And so it goes to show like what an incredible, like how your mind projects her just into the shadows, into these other spaces.
Yeah.
And so I was like, that's a great lesson right there. Let's be really smart about that. But she needs to be able to make appearances. We can't always be just looking at the shadows. So I was just thinking, well, how can we, other ways we can bring her to life? And one of the ideas I brought to the table is just the idea, grown up Catholic, I love altar boys. Well, I love the idea of altar boys.
Yeah.
There's something creepy about it. I don't love altar boys. That's the thing to cut out. And this began the investigation, not only into those two murders, but also into what did he mean by that growing up Catholic? Okay, it's a pattern. It's a pattern that we got to get to the bottom of. Maybe this is good. Maybe you leave this in. No. So I was like, because I was like, okay, you know, the nun is this, you know, we do this blasphemous twist on her. James did this incredible, you know, creation of making this blasphemous twist on a nun with with Valak. What if we did the same thing with an altar boy? And I just thought, okay, that's a cool image right there. And that he's kind of, you know, summoned to be her little minion. I was like, oh, that's going to be fun. And then I started looking, and there's this great street photography of this altar boy in Spain in the 30s. And it's like in a funeral procession.
I was
possession. There's that word again.
I can't even.
I have the problem.
It was a possession that had a procession behind it. That's how they used to do it back then. So it was this funeral procession, and I should dig up the photo and just send it over to you guys if you like.
Oh, I would
putting
love to see it.
It was so amazing because he's got a thurible, which are those things that hold the incense.
Yep.
And there's smoke coming out of that, but the street is covered in smoke. And it's in the 30s, 40s. Basically, it's 30s, 40s Spain. The whole picture looks creepy and magical and just amazing. So I was like, ooh, that's it. Like, that's the vibe. We got to give it a thurible. And I was like, how can we weaponize a thurible? So then it kind of went from there. But that was one of the kind of manifestations. I was like, okay, that's going to be in the movie. Then we had the goat demon, which was just that, you guys saw, which I think it was one of those things that, you know, I went back and watched Bram Stoker's Dracula. Yeah. And just because I know that was a big inspiration for Corin. And I was like, okay, what are those things that I love about it? And I love the practical effects of that bat creature, because that bat creature was just, it stuck with me, I think, more than anything in that movie. And it's just, it's so high impact and so scary. And I just was like, oh, I want to have like something like that. That's all practical. And we found this amazing actor, AJ, from England. And he was just this really athletic stunt performer. And we did these auditions, and he even built his like these little like arm extensions. And he just brought this incredible ferocity to the performance. And I was like, oh my gosh, he looks scary just running around like that. Like, he's got this crazy energy. And I'm like, we get him, we just get some amazing makeup on it. And it just, he took that character to life. I mean, it was, and it's great having that on set, not just like, I mean, everyone, you know, obviously practical effects are amazing whenever you can do it. But like the thing that everyone, it's not even just what you're shooting, it's also just how the actors respond to it. That's especially with a horror movie, especially with kids. Like, they were terrified. Like, everyone gets terrified when he comes on set, because he's making his like snorting and deep breathing, and you're just like, oh shit, you know. And there's this great energy, and like everyone feeds off that. And that's, you know, if you just had a guy in a green suit, or you just had like, you know, tennis balls to show where you're supposed to look, you lose that magic. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's so much as much for the performance for the actors on set as it is for the audience when you're seeing it. So that was really fun. And then just the other manifestations, you know, there's, you know, a couple sequences. There's one thing in France that's like unique to France that I was kind of building off of, which is this, it's like this cultural thing. Basically, if you, people will like, kind of like graffiti, they'll make faces out of the environment. So if there's there's like a manhole cover with like two holes, somebody will draw like a smiley face.
Huh.
And so you go around like the streets of France, and like, you'll see like little like faces everywhere. And it's like so amazing. I was like, okay, that's like this cool cultural thing. I was like, can we build off of that? Can we make her just appear in the environment? And it also felt very much in line with just the way we've seen Valak in these movies, where there's something artistic about the scares. There's something that almost isn't just conjuring. There's almost like a little bit of like a Nightmare on Elm Street in these sequences, where there's like a visual component to it.
Yeah.
You know, even the Crooked Man, you know, has this, you know, this, you know, in the, you know, the kinescope, or
yep,
probably got that wrong. You know, there's this kind of this artistry to it. And I just thought that, you know, I want to do more of that. And I think it's what makes it's what makes Valak unique. And it also even reminds me of, back to Bram Stoker's Dracula, there's so much of that, you know, the shadow play on the wall. There's so much of that old school horror movie craft that goes into it. So I was like, how can we take that further? And so that evolved into the newsstand sequence, which was like,
oh my gosh,
originally,
that
was
scene.
That practical?
It started all practical, and then things started to break down, and we eventually had to do, there's still practical elements in there, but there had to be some CG elements, because we couldn't make the pages turn that fast and or line up that well. it became this kind of it became a little.
But you tried it. You tried it.
Oh, 100%. And there's still practical elements in there. It just you needed CG to kind of
wow.
To
well,
take
didn't
it to
you
the next
say
level.
They did? They had a setup on Santa Monica or something where they actually like recreated it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's crazy. Like, how is that done?
It's on a loop, right? Like, it, all the magazines are set up on a newsstand. Where? Santa Monica Pier?
I think it was in Venice.
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 So, yeah, they basically did that. And that was, and yeah, you could see it there. I don't know if they still have it up, but I mean, it was pretty impressive with her. And, you know, it kind of plays out how it does in the movie. But yeah. I was impressed that they got that because, I mean, you know, as much as they did. So, yeah, that was one of those things. And it started with that idea of I was like, you know, I want to do a flip book, but that's also a collage that spreads across these different pages of the magazine.
And how would you even trigger something like that practically?
Demonic forces.
Hello.
I mean, that's one of the days we didn't bless the set because we needed all the demonic forces. Still didn't have enough. Really, because of labor issues. There was just they have their own union.
I was just going to say geographically and architecturally. It's breathtaking just to be inside the places you put the audience in, and your longtime cinematographer, Tristan Nyby, capture them and let us really marinate inside each of these frames in such a cool way. What sorts of things does Tristan bring out in you as a creative partner?
Yeah, I've worked with Tristan for years. I've known him forever, and you know he shot the Billie Eilish video that I did.
Oh,
he shot The Maiden, my short film, and so long friendship and collaboration that goes back there. The other person that as we're talking about the visuals and we're talking about the world, Stefan Croissant, who is my production designer. He absolutely needs a call out here. And it was honestly that trifecta. I mean, he was so essential in bringing these visuals together. And he's a French production designer and my first time working with him, but he has done so many movies. He's been an art director on everything from like Dunkirk and the last Wes Anderson movies and just like really talented guy. And this is him working as a production designer. And I think having a French production designer really brought a lot to it. And he just kind of kept me, you know, really honest. A lot of with everything, we just started with a lot of looking through old photos, like just looking through photos of the period. Cause I was like, I really want to nail the period. I really, you know, we haven't been alive in the 50s. And so I really want to feel like we're transported there. So that was one of the core where we started. And then from that, you know, he was really great in just guiding us with the finding great locations and just incredible places to set it. So I think that's the best thing about shooting in France. It's like, you know, like a new building there is 100 years old.
Yeah.
You know, beyond that. And then it just gets older and it goes back to like, you're like walking on top of like Roman ruins and there's so much texture there. And so you can just build off of that. You can build off that texture. And that's one of the things that I love in horror movies is there is so much like the movies that I grew up on and the movies that I love, they have this great texture. And I wanted to get that in the movie. And Tristan, absolutely, you know, it's like, you know, having the locations is enough. You got to have someone who can light it and shoot it. And I one of the things that I love about Tristan is he really and one of the big mantras that we had was like, let's keep it real. We're like going back to old photos. Let's try and like make it feel like we're in a boarding school in France in the 1950s. Let's try and make it feel like we're really there. One of the things with Tristan, we were really big about using natural lighting and just making it look as not like a movie. You know, it's so easy to light it like a movie and to even with night, that's one of those things that it's incredibly, once you start looking at it, like it's so obvious movies that have nighttime movie lighting. And it, for me watching a horror movie, it's like, sometimes you have to do it. Cause it's this conundrum because, okay, well it would be almost too dark to see. So you need to see something, but just drawing that line of like dark, but not too dark. And how do you motivate that? How do you bring light into these settings? How is it you're not just looking at a blank screen? And, you know, that's always this careful balance. And I'm really happy with where we got because it really, there's a lot of it's lit by like practical lighting. And I think that brings you into the movie. It just makes it feel like this is real.
Yeah. And it makes it very unique from all the other movies in the Conjuring universe as well. You know, the way you guys do it. I also want to talk about something very unique to the Conjuring universe. I believe that this is the first time Marco Beltrami has been brought in to score something in the Conjuring universe. Is this true?
Absolutely. Yeah. Marco's amazing. And, you know, I've I really enjoyed working with him. He's obviously, you know, has great, great legendary, you know, resume with like the Scream movies.
Exactly.
And, you know, but he can go beyond that with like, you know, Ford versus Ferrari and just like all the amazing things that he does. So he was great. He was great to work with. And then we, you know, we really just wanted to make something that had, it's so easy to go really big with these scores, especially I think the natural inclination with you're doing this kind of big Catholic horror movie is to bring out, you know, big, you know, choir or something that's kind of, you know, we've heard a lot of times. It's kind of fun to listen to, but it's like, sometimes it feels a little bit too over the top and again, too much like a movie.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
I was thinking, let's just try and anchor it. Let's try and make it feel, as relatable as possible. And I think, you know, for some of it with the nuns, we were even talking about like, well, what are the instruments that, that speak to the nuns? And we started talking about like violins and stuff and, the idea or like fiddles. And I just love the idea of, I was like, I want it to feel humble. Like, I don't want it to feel like all grandiose. Cause there was a kind of a line in the movie that didn't end up working out. So we cut it. But this idea that, you know, when the nuns are like together and they're telling their story, that they have this kind of little catchphrase, which is like the nuns do all the work, the priests get all the credit, which is something that I always thought was kind of like awesome. And it didn't quite fit in the tone of the movie or in that scene, but it's like the idea that the nuns are these like foot soldiers of the Catholic Church, that they are the ones who just do all the work and they don't get any of the credit. They're never going to be the Pope. They're never going to get promoted up. And then you see like, then even the, like the legend of Father Burke, it's like, you know, he's promoted, he becomes bishop or something. Like the idea that it's like, there's plenty of room for promotion for all the guys in the Catholic Church, but the nuns have got to do the dirty work. They're the ones who are doing the hard work. And so I just like, I loved that idea. And I, you know, I think that he did a really nice job of like weaving that in with more just humble instruments, you know, stuff that you can just feel like it tells their story, you know?
Yeah. All right. Okay. We're wrapping it up here, but two more quick questions. Did you keep anything? Without spoiling anything, did you keep anything?
Oh, you know what? The one thing that I wanted to keep, I don't have. I think it got pulled away before I could grab it.
Okay.
I took the chalice from Conjuring 3.
Oh, that was that's awesome.
Because I was like, I loved the design of that.
Yes.
And I was like, oh my gosh, that needs to be part of my collection. But I didn't, there was like a bunch of little things. It's so funny. I didn't take one of the key items.
Well, maybe we'll get to see it in like the Warner Brothers archives.
Exactly. I'll see you next time I'm here. You will get it at like an auction, you know?
Who knows, right? Who knows? We're looking for it. Okay. So moving forward, this movie's going to command a sequel. It's going to be a smash. I mean, I'm just predicting the future here. Have you thought about where to take it? Or do you have to kind of get out of the way for what's coming next? What James has in store? I mean, if he's got this whole plan.
You know, I've actually talked with the actors about things that, you know, could happen. I mean, the great thing is knowing where it's going. You know that it will lead to this fateful exorcism with the Warrens. So I think that was something that was always really exciting. And I think it's like throttling that timeline about, you know, how quickly we get to that event was always one of the big debates. And it was interesting because actually that was one of the things. Well, I wonder how much I should actually say. I'm gonna put a pin in that.
You got it.
There's always discussion with that. And, you know, honestly, I started as a fan of this franchise, and it's been one of the greatest pleasures just being a part of it. I really love that you're a part of it,
man. What you bring to it is extraordinary. And anything else that we can watch for you, a project or anything else coming out beyond this?
You know, there's a couple of things. I don't know if I can talk about it.
Sure.
Right now,
but that's exciting. That's in the horror vein?
I love the horror space. Honestly, I only want to be making horror movies and coming back here to talk to you about it with you guys.
Yes. Hell yeah. You should do another Billie Eilish video too, by the way.
Oh, I would love to. God. You know, she's directing her own videos. You know, she's honestly so talented. It was like, she's a very talented artist.
No, it's amazing. All right, okay, you got anything else before we go?
No, I know we gotta wrap, but everybody listening, make sure you stay through the end, through the credits.
Yes, go see it. You're gonna have the time of your life. So congratulations on The Nun 2. Opens in theaters, only in theaters, September 8th. All right, so grab your friends, have an amazing time. Michael, thank you so much again for stopping by.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah! Thank you.
That was the Boot Crew Podcast, episode 398. Thank you for being the most important
part of it. Production tracks for this one provided by the good folks at Powerman 5000. Till next time, from myself, Trevor, Lauren, and Leo, it is the Boo Crew saying, sweet screams.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Boo Crew Podcast. Haunt the Boo Crew at TalesFromTheBooCrew.com. Tales from the Boo Crew on Facebook and Instagram. Follow us on Twitter at Tales from the Boo. The Boo Crew is Lauren and Trevor Shand and Leone D'Antonio. The Boo Crew is produced by Lauren Shand, chopped and sliced by Trevor Shand. The Boo Crew is a TSP creation, part of the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Bye.
A Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, home of the Boo Crew, horror-centric interviews, SCP archives, weekly full cast storytelling, horror queers, genre commentary from an LGBTQ perspective, and creepy, for disturbing and terrifying creepypastas. Listen free wherever you stream audio and at bloodydisgusting.com/podcasts.